Good evening, Tuesday night Bible study on the book of Acts. We're going to do chapter 23 today. Again, it's not super long, so we can do a whole chapter in one evening. If you remember, in chapter 22, there were Jews from Ephesus who recognized Paul in the temple. Actually, that was the end of chapter 21. And so they started a riot and were upset with Paul. So the Roman Tribune, who is over 1,000 soldiers, he comes in and arrests Paul. Paul asks if he can speak to the crowd. The Tribune says yes. So Paul speaks to them, starts to calm them down a little bit, but then mentions Gentiles, and that gets the crowd all roiled up again because they falsely think that Paul has brought a Gentile into the temple, which of course would be forbidden. So then the riot is beginning again, so the Tribune removes Paul, takes him into the barracks, and is about to, I love this, interrogate him by flogging. And that's when Paul appeals to his Roman citizenship, and that puts the brakes on everything. So the Tribune says, okay, you're right, we don't punish a Roman citizen without a trial. So, then he commands the Jewish leaders to come to him and report why they're upset with Paul. So it's really kind of the semblance of a trial. And that's where chapter 23 starts. So what I just recapped was just the end of chapter 21 all the way through 22. Okay? So any lingering questions or comments from last week about that? Yeah, great.
History question. If the consul or if the Roman guard would have killed Paul, would they have been subject to death?
I don't know. They would have been subject to punishment for killing a Roman citizen without a trial.
Because that was
so there was that was like a right.
They don't know.
Yes. Whether that would be punishment by death or just something else, I don't know what the punishment would have been. Yeah. So that's why, you know, actually in the Wednesday class last week, Dale Spencer asked, well, how do they know Paul wasn't lying and saying he was a Roman citizen when he might not have been? How do they know? And I actually looked that up and read a little bit on it. There was such a thing as a certificate that if you bought your way into Roman citizenship, they would issue you a certificate. However, Paul was born into citizenship because one of his parents was a Roman citizen. So I don't know that he would have had that certificate, and even if he did, it was probably back home under his mattress in Tarsus, you know? He wouldn't carry that around with him. They would have found it, because they strip search him, you know, that kind of thing. So the only reason they believed him is because the penalties were so great. If you lied about your Roman citizenship, or if you punished a Roman citizen without a trial or approval of that he was guilty of something, the punishment was severe. And that's the only thing that's holding them to tell the truth, I think. Yeah, good question, though. Okay, so let's start. Chapter 23, verse 1. And looking intently at the council, Paul said, brothers, I have lived my life before God in all good conscience up to this day. So right there he's saying, I know I haven't done anything wrong. He's basically declaring his innocence. Verse 2, and the high priest, Ananias, commanded those who stood by him to strike him on the mouth. So that sounds very familiar with what happened to who else?
Mm-hmm.
Jesus. So yes, Jesus said something, I don't remember, I should have looked it up, and they struck him across the face. So this is very similar. And Ananias is the one who commanded it, so not the one who did it. Verse 3, then Paul said to him, God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. Are you sitting to judge me according to the law, and yet contrary to the law, you order me to be struck? That sounds pretty harsh. So there's a little debate, very minor debate. Was Paul claiming a curse against the high priest by saying God is going to strike you? Is that a curse, or is that a prediction or a prophecy? I personally think it's a prophecy or a prediction. He's not, Paul, Christians, Jews, Paul, we don't throw curses at other people. That's something that pagans do, is curse one another. So I don't think this is a curse. Paul is just predicting. God is going to strike you. because you're judging me according to the law, and yet you just broke the law. Now, what law is he referring to? I actually looked it up, and I did not write it in my notes, sadly. It's in Leviticus that God says, do no injustice in court. So while someone is under trial, you are to protect them. It's kind of, you know what? I think it's almost an implication of you're innocent until proven guilty. It doesn't say that. But God does command the Israelites in Leviticus that you don't harm a person who's under trial while they're in court. So that's what happened here. So the high priest is judging Paul according to the law, supposedly, and yet breaking the law, in God's law, in doing so. Now what does he mean by whitewashed wall? Anybody know what that means?
Pastor, in the note I have here in I Self-Study Bible, said he was noted for his cruelty and violence. And when the revolt against Rome broke out, he was assassinated by his own people.
Yeah. So the Jews themselves did not like Ananias, the high priest. He was a particularly cruel man. So part of the reason why maybe he had this impulse to say, Paul, who are you to tell us you're innocent? Smack him for me, you know, whoever's standing next to Paul. You know, hit him for me. And they did, strike him on the mouth. So to me that sounds not like a punch, but a slap, which could still hurt. But, so yes, they didn't like Ananias. We know that from history. So what does he mean by whitewashed wall? Jesus used the same analogy in talking to Jewish leaders. Do you remember?
Whitewashed tomb.
Exactly. So it's the same thing, only here, whitewashed wall, because some tombs were in the side of a cave, and they would have a stone placed in front. So it's the same thing. Because what they would do, now where is it? See, I didn't put that in my notes either. Jesus said that. He said to the Pharisees and the Jewish leaders, you whitewash tombs. That's what he called them. Now, what's the history behind that? Well, if you touched a dead body, you were unclean. Right? You've heard that or heard me say it, or if you haven't, now you have. If you touched a dead body, you were unclean, and I think, I'd have to go back and search it a little bit, I think you were unclean for 7 days, which meant you could not go into the temple. So it was both theological to say that the worst form of uncleanness is death. Death is a result of sin, right? But I think there was also a smidgen of health consciousness in there, so that if you were one of the people who's helping out a family when their loved one dies by being a pallbearer, so you're touching the dead one, just to make sure there's no transfer of germs or anything, you're not allowed in the temple for 7 days. So it was a big deal to be a pallbearer or to touch a dead person. Well, the Pharisees, what were they inclined to do? We know this from Jesus, talking about them all the time. They nitpicked about all kinds of details and developed man-made rules that were expanding of God's commands. Right? Sound familiar? So this debate happened where they said, well, what counts as touching a dead body? Oh, for crying out loud, right? Does walking over a grave count as touching a dead body? Now, I would say common sense would say no. But they decided, yes. Walking over a grave counts as touching a dead body. And further, you're desecrating the grave anyway. Okay, that I can understand. You don't want to walk on a grave. So what they would do is they would whitewash the graves. After somebody was buried, they'd have some kind of white varnish or white paint or something, and they would paint it white, and yes, over time it would fade or wash away. They'd have to redo it periodically. And if you were buried in a tomb in the side of a cave, like Jesus was, they would whitewash the wall so that you knew there is something dead here, a person. There's a dead person here. Don't touch, under penalty of being declared unclean and forbidden from the temple for 7 days. Jesus used that when he was chastising the Pharisees. He said, You, and I don't remember the quote, so I'm kind of paraphrasing, something like about you whitewash tombs. You look pretty on the outside, and inside are filled with corrupt bones. Well, is that all of us? We try to look pretty on the outside, right? Meaning proper and good and Christ-like and living a good life, and yet what's on the inside of all of us? Sin, bad thoughts, jealousy, greed, impatience, anger. It's all bubbling inside, right? So we're filled with sin, yet on the outside, we try to look good for each other, right? Which we should.
Yeah.
We should do that. That's the history behind this comment about whitewashed wall. And the Jewish leaders there, including the high priest, would know exactly what Paul was saying. He's calling them, he's saying about them, you're trying to look good and proper on the outside, and yet inside you're corrupt. Which they were. They were corrupt.
So, would there have been people back in that time whose job was to tend to dead bodies, or was that more like taken care of by the women and the families and the preparation for burial?
Good question. I really don't know.
Because that person would just be perpetually unclean and not able to...
That's away. True.
So that's...
Yes, a person like who's going about repainting the graves every few weeks or every month.
Well,
yeah, they're kind
about,
of perpetually unclean.
Think about like nowadays, like
yeah.
a petition or somebody who's
yeah.
a caretaker. Like,
I really don't know the answer to that. My suspicion is the family members would take turns, and so, okay, your turn. You know, kind of like today, we go put flowers on a person's grave periodically, right? That might be the sense. I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know.
I'm thinking more about the profession of, like, there wouldn't...
There might have been a professional, who took care of all the graves?
No, like, would there have been a professional person? Like, would there have been...
A funeral director? A mortician?
We don't speak the same language, you know that. it was just kind of taken care of by...
I don't know.
Okay.
I have not read anything about anything like that, so I don't know. Jeannie?
Well, they had professional mourners.
Well,
yeah, that's true, they did.
This also made me think, too, at Jesus' burial, it was the women who had the grave.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't...
No men. Maybe the women were doing it because that was their role, or...
Out of love?
To keep the men from making themselves unclean so that they could still go to the temple and...
That's a very good point. I never thought about that. Mm-hmm. That it was the women who were tending to Jesus in his death,
mm-hmm.
and maybe that was part of their role, or maybe it was part of them just trying to prevent the men from having to be unclean and not go to the temple. Yeah, they were all chicken and scared. Yeah, they were all shaking in fear, right? Bunch of scaredy cats. all good thoughts. Yeah, I don't really know, but that's a good way to think about it. All right. So Paul responds to the high priest, and then verse 4. Those who stood by said, "Would you revile God's high priest?" And Paul said, "I did not know, brothers, that he was the high priest. For it is written, you shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people." Wow. Is Paul apologizing there? Kind of is, isn't he? That's an apology. Sort of. I mean, not a full apology. Please forgive me. You know, that kind of thing. But he's saying, I didn't know he was the high priest. And you shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people. So I imagine, now this is just me in my own mind speculating, had Paul known it was the high priest, that Ananias was the high priest, he still might have responded, but not so harshly about, God is going to strike you. He might have said something a little more professional, I don't know, a little less harsh, maybe. He probably would have still responded, but maybe not in that way. So, yeah, I think this is kind of an apology from Paul. Should we apologize even to our enemies? That's a hard thing to do. Somebody who really hates you or despises you or dislikes you, you know, or whatever. I don't know that... Have any of you had that experience? To my knowledge, I don't know that I have. That I've ever... There's somebody that I could name and say, yeah, that person really hates me. They despise me. They're my enemy. And you think, wow, do I have to apologize to that person? I mean, that might happen from time to time. Yeah, actually, I think I have had to do that. Just now that I think about it.
You don't have a Will Wheaton?
What's that?
You don't have a Will Wheaton?
Yeah, Will Wheaton, right. Okay, Big Bang Theory quote there, huh? Reference. All right, verse 6. Now when Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council. Oh, this is so clever, isn't it? Wasn't Jesus often clever in his responses?
Oh, yeah.
Jesus would turn around, they would interrogate him or ask him something, and he would turn around with another question that would make them kind of think about their original intent. Paul is doing that here too. So, he saw that some were Sadducees and others Pharisees. He cried out in the council, "Brothers, I am a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees. It is with respect to the hope and the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial." Now we already know, but here it's reinforced as well. The Pharisees believe. Let me read the next one. And when he had said this, a dissension arose between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. For the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, no angel, nor spirit, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. Which is absolutely true. We know from elsewhere in church writings that this, which I, how can the Sadducees even call themselves Jews? Because a resurrection is in the Old Testament. And angels are in the Old Testament. So is the Spirit. So Sadducees, I think, were like the original secular Jewish people. They kind of denied some core Jewish beliefs. And yet, they were the rulers of the temple. Pharisees, you remember, were the ones who were the teachers of the law. And they ran the synagogues. And there was an ongoing dispute between the Pharisees and Sadducees about resurrection. Pharisees believed in it, and Sadducees did not. And they tried to use that, by the way, one time to trick Jesus, and he got out of it, if you remember. So, Paul sees that. And so he says, I'm a Pharisee, which he was. So he's telling the truth. He's a son of a Pharisee, again, telling the truth. And it is respect to the hope and the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial. Is that true? Why is he on trial? Because he's been preaching Jesus, really, the core of it. The original reason he, or the most recent reason is because they thought he brought a Gentile into the temple. But prior to that, they were mad at him because he was preaching against, against Jewish law, which he wasn't. And prior to that, they were mad at him because he was preaching Jesus. And what was he preaching about Jesus? The resurrection of Jesus. So really, if you kind of follow back their train of thinking over these past couple of chapters, really the core of what they're upset about is that he switched sides. He was a Pharisee, and now he's preaching about Jesus and that Jesus rose from the dead. How can you do that, Paul? And then they're mad at him about this, and then about that, and then about that. So he's telling the truth. It's respect to the hope of the Savior, the Messiah, and the resurrection of the dead that I'm on trial. Well, as soon as he aligns himself with the Pharisees, all the Sadducees get mad. All the Pharisees maybe are a little bit proud or, you know, attached to him, connected to him. So you immediately divide the council. And now they start arguing between themselves. Really kind of clever, actually, don't you think? I think it was. Jesus did that often as well when they came and tried to trick him with trick questions. All right, so where are we? Any comments, thoughts, questions? Yeah, Rich.
The position of the Pharisees and the Sadducees, is that something that they created themselves? Because in the Old Testament, you have the description of the high priest and the regular priest and the Levites, but I don't recall ever reading anywhere, these are Pharisees and this is what the Pharisees do.
That's correct. It was kind of man-made. And so, it is an outflow of the Old Testament, though. Because from the Sadducees came the priests and the high priest. So that's kind of an organization of the priestly class. They were also supposed to teach God's word. And that morphed into the Pharisees. They became the teachers of the law. So both of them are kind of, sort of, hinted at or directed, their functions are coming out of the Old Testament. But as an organization, which they were both organizations, and their structure and their names, those were man-made. So, you know, I guess like as a modern-day Christian, we can say the Sadducees did form initially a godly purpose. They cared for the temple, and they were the ones who performed the sacrifices. So you brought your lamb in for a sacrifice, you would give it to a Sadducee, and they would go up to the altar and they would sacrifice it for you. So the Sadducees did perform a godly function. The Pharisees too. Does God want us to learn about his word? Yeah. So they taught God's word. They were teachers of the law. That was their name and their function. And they did it for a good reason. The problem is, of course, they went overboard and then started adding on more details and more rules and more requirements to God's law. So both of them kind of went off the rails.
Yeah. This point in time, they were no longer descendants of Aaron, necessarily.
That is true, because some of the high priests used kind of political manipulation to get appointed as high priests. So they weren't necessarily the direct line from Aaron like they were supposed to be. That is true. That is correct, yeah.
And were they also mixed in with the Roman politics? Because the Romans would sometimes appoint
high priests. Yeah, right. So the Romans would have like veto power over the high priest, and they would decide who could or couldn't be it. So yes, politics were getting mixed in as well.
So then, in the New Testament, we don't really read about the Essenes, but they were also priests, and from what I've read, they had like a retreat, I guess you would say, where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found.
Yes.
In Qumran.
That's right.
And they had a huge library there, so scribes were there.
Yep.
The book of Isaiah and every book in the Old Testament except for Esther.
Yes.
Is in.
Absolutely correct. Do you remember that, Jill, when we were in Israel?
Mm-hmm.
We were out by Jericho, actually, and we did have, I don't know, an hour or so stop, so fairly brief stop, but at the site of an Essenes encampment where they lived. They were kind of almost a little bit monastery-like, because they would retreat from the rest of Jewish culture, and part of what they considered their function was to preserve God's word. So they were copying it down and writing it, and then they would store it in, you know, waterproof clay containers with sealed lids, and that's where we got the Dead Sea Scrolls from. So it was actually a great benefit to Christianity in general, because the Dead Sea Scrolls helped to validate a lot of the Old Testament. Yeah, you were going to say something?
Well, didn't they show us the cave where they...
Up on the side.
I didn't mean like we were right there, but I remember standing there in all the ruins of that community and looking across.
Yeah.
Were they the ones that had that put the...
No, all of the Jewish leaders would do that. The little phylacteries on their heads.
Oh, like boxes.
Yeah, that wasn't just them. That was God said through Moses, you know, to write it on your, place it on your door jambs and upon your hearts, and you know, so they would put it in a little box and put it. Yeah, that was many of them. But yeah, we were standing on the floor of the Jordan Valley where this site of the Essenes was, and he said, "See up there? See that little hole right there? Yeah." That's where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found by a shepherd who was chasing his goats up there and threw a rock and it broke open and he found them. And he was illiterate, so he didn't know what he had, so he sold them all to a museum curator for a pair of sandals. And our guide said, "That's the most expensive pair of sandals that anyone's ever purchased in the history of the world." I think
he had bought any NBA's tennis shoes.
Yeah, right. I think whoever bought all the Dead Sea Scrolls for a pair of sandals took advantage. They should have given him more. They knew what they were buying. Did you have your hand up again, Jean?
Yeah. The Essenes, they had very strict community rules.
Mm-hmm.
And some would consider it like a prototype or a precursor to baptism. And I even heard Dr. Oswald Hoffman say years ago that
have heard that too, and I think there's some credibility to that idea that John the Baptist was one of the Essenes. Yeah.
And the Essenes had a practice of taking in orphans.
Yeah.
And since John the Baptist's parents were elderly when he was born, it's likely he had not come to adulthood, so he may have been in that community.
He might have.
And God used that to prepare John for the baptism.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
Because they had a ritual washing.
They did. They did, absolutely right.
And I also read, and there's a book up there if anybody wants to read it about the Dead Sea Scrolls. But I also read that, just lost my point. what was it? What was it from? Oh, many of the scribes and Pharisees, and maybe Sadducees too, I don't know, who were centered in Jerusalem, were done with the politics of it, and the mixing with Rome and everything. So many of them would retreat to Qumran to study the law, copy the law, observe the law, and their rituals and everything. And the Essenes also believed in two messiahs.
That I didn't know. I hadn't heard that.
A servant type.
Okay.
Old Testament type.
Right.
And the conquering king.
Oh. No, I didn't know that. That's interesting. Yeah. Very good. Okay. So, for the Sadducees say there's no resurrection, no angels, no spirit, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. Verse 9. Then a great clamor arose, and some of the scribes of the Pharisees' party stood up and contended sharply. We find nothing wrong with this in this man. What if a spirit or an angel spoke to him? So right there, you know how humanity often gathers into its own little groups, cliques. You see that in schools all the time, right? Sadly. Part of human nature, I think, fallen human nature, but nevertheless it happens. So some of the Pharisees are declaring Paul is innocent simply based on the fact that he's one of us. So he must be innocent. That's what they're saying. What if a spirit or an angel spoke to him? Yes, a spirit and an angel did speak to him by the name of Jesus. It was Jesus who spoke to him. Jesus is elsewhere called the angel of the Lord. So, I think that would apply. Verse 10. And when the dissension became violent, the tribune, afraid that Paul would be torn to pieces by them, commanded the soldiers to go down and take him away from among them by force and bring him into the barracks. So they're rescuing Paul because another riot is developing among the leaders. Why is there this tendency amongst some humanity in our human nature that when we don't get our way or we can't settle an argument, we become physical or violent? That happens, doesn't it? Yeah. So the tribune comes to the rescue, sends the soldiers into the fray, bring Paul out. The following night, the Lord stood by him and said, take courage, for as you have testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem, so you must testify also in Rome. So yes, if you have a red letter Bible, is the Lutheran Study Bible red letter? Because, yes, we do think that the Lord, that's a reference to Jesus. Now, is this a vision or a dream? We don't know. But somehow, Paul got the message from Jesus, and Jesus says, have courage, be patient, I want you to go to Rome and talk there and give the testimony about me there. Well, that, I think, Paul, knowing he was already a man of great faith and great courage, I think that would give him a lot of peace of mind to know that, okay, God's with me, I don't know what's going to happen. We already know, remember Paul said this back at the end of his third missionary journey when everybody kept saying, don't go to Jerusalem, they're going to arrest you. And he said, I don't care. And if I have to die, I don't care. I'm ready. That was Paul's attitude. What an attitude, right? So here too, Paul's like, okay, all right, Jesus, you say I got to go to Rome, I'll go to Rome. I don't care what happens to me. Verse 12. When it was day, the Jews made a plot and bound themselves by an oath neither to eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. Boy, they are upset. Yep. So by the Jews, which Jews does that mean? I don't know. Probably a mixture of Sadducees and Pharisees, or maybe mostly Sadducees, because they were the ones most upset, I think. So they're going to fast until one of them has succeeded in assassinating Paul. Verse 13, there were more than 40 who made this conspiracy. Odd detail. Why do they have that detail in here? Why does Luke write that for us? I don't know, but we're about to find out why they know that, why that is known. Okay, verse 14, they went to the chief priests and elders and said, we have strictly bound ourselves by an oath to taste no food till we have killed Paul. Now therefore you, along with the council, give notice to the tribune to bring him down to you as though you were going to determine his case more exactly. And we are ready to kill him before he comes near. So what do you call that when a council or a ruling authority is conspiracy, right? So they're conspiring with the council, so there must have been at least a few members of the council who were in agreement and had outright hatred for Paul, and they're like, okay, under a pretense, we'll tell the tribune to bring Paul back to us. We want to have a more measured approach and find out more exactly about his case, and when he's about to arrive here or somewhere on the way, you assassinate him. So, there's a conspiracy going on, absolutely. All right, verse 16. Now the son of Paul's sister heard of their ambush, so he went and entered the barracks and told Paul. First of all, first thing that comes to my mind is, this is the first we've heard of Paul's family. He's got a sister and a nephew. Wow. And now they're from Tarsus, so why is the nephew here in Jerusalem? Well, he must have been a good Jew and he was there for Pentecost, or he heard that his uncle Paul was coming back from the third missionary journey and he wanted to visit, so he came down from Tarsus. Uncle Paul. Imagine calling St. Paul, the apostle, Uncle Paul. That'd be something, huh? So, he must have been nearby or on the edges or whatever, and he heard this plot about ambushing his uncle. So he went and entered the barracks. There again is something a little bit curious. Why does Paul's nephew get permission to enter the barracks? It would have been guarded by the Roman soldiers. So again, kind of like when Jesus was on trial, maybe Paul's nephew was known by the soldiers standing guard at the door, was known that this is Paul's nephew. And so since Paul is not yet convicted, he's allowed visitors, here's his nephew, we'll let the nephew in. That's my supposition. Yes, you're right. His sister would have been too.
So the nephew would have been a Roman citizen.
Well, I guess that's true. You're right. Good observation. So the nephew would have been a Roman citizen. So he would have been afforded some extra rights that others did not have. Kind of like being an American citizen, right? We have extra rights, don't we?
Guarantee.
Guarantee.
Yeah, the note here says, since Paul was not convicted of a crime, he was allowed to have visitors.
Oh, good. Well, there we go. The Lutheran Study Bible agrees with me. Really, the other way around. All right. So Paul, or the nephew goes in. So he went and entered the barracks and told Paul. Paul called one of the centurions and said to him, take this young man to the tribune, for he has something to tell him. So he took him and brought him to the tribune and said, Paul, the prisoner, called me and asked me to bring this young man to you as he has something to say. The tribune took him by the hand and, going aside, asked him privately, what is it that you have to tell me? Boy, they're acting very politely towards Paul's nephew, aren't they?
Again, he's a Roman citizen.
Well, I think you're right. That's a good observation, Jeannie. He would have been a Roman citizen too, so that's part of it. He's given extra deference. All right, what is it you have to tell me? Verse 20, and he said, the Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down to the council tomorrow as though they were going to inquire somewhat more closely about him. Let me scroll up. But do not be persuaded by them, for more than 40 of their men are lying in ambush for him, who have bound themselves by an oath neither to eat nor drink till they have killed him. And now they are ready, waiting for your consent. Verse 22. So the tribune dismissed the young man, charging him, tell no one that you have informed me of these things. Okay. Bless you.
Thank you.
Kind of an interesting little story here going on, right? A little bit of a narrative. All right. Why would the tribune, so that's pretty high up, so Paul's nephew gets all through the centurions all the way to the tribune. He's the ruler over 1,000 soldiers. Why does the tribune tell him, tell no one that you informed me of these things? Why would the tribune say that?
Well, he's probably planning how to...
Well, if he would have come in earlier, if the word got out.
Yeah.
I think it's probably a storm the place or something.
I think that's a possibility. Also, probably the tribune is in his mind trying to think, what am I going to do about this? So he doesn't want the public to know that he knows so he can take action. I think, and this again is just speculation on my part, because I don't really know the answer to my own question, but I speculate that he's just trying to protect the young man. He's saying, if you tell anybody you've talked to me, your own life is going to be in danger. Because then they're going to be mad at you for telling, for warning me about protecting Paul. So, one of those various reasons, or all of them.
Do you think it could be, too, that he's kind of nervous because he was going to have Paul flogged and now he's trying to no. be extra nice and yeah. careful?
You know, that's a very likely possibility. Because if he had flogged Paul and then found out he was a Roman citizen, he would be up to punishment for having flogged a Roman citizen unconvicted without being on trial. So, yes, that is a good possibility, too. He's being extra nice. All right, continuing on. We can finish this up then. What's our time-wise? Okay. Then he called two of the centurions and said, get ready, 200 soldiers, with 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen, to go as far as Caesarea at the third hour of the night. What's our footnote say here? Oh, 9 p.m. Yeah, because they considered nightfall generally was at 6 p.m., plus or minus a little bit, depending on the season. So, 9 o'clock at night. So, two centurions. Get together your men. Well, it's more than 200, but, you know, borrow a few from that other centurion. You know, whatever. I'm going to have you escort Paul out of here in the middle of the night. Not quite the middle of the night, but yeah. 24, also provide mounts for Paul to ride and bring him safely to Felix, the governor. So that's who the tribune reports to, is the governor. Which would be, the governor would be, Felix the governor would be the equivalent of Pontius Pilate. So it was military rule. They were ruled by politicians, kind of like we are today in America, right? The military reports to the politicians, namely the president. So, he's going to escort him to Felix. What do you call this? Look at verse 25. And he wrote a letter to this effect. We'll read that here in just a second. What do you call this? Passing the buck?
Right.
The tribune is like, I don't know what to do. I'm going to send him up the chain to my boss and let him deal with this matter. That's what he's doing. I'll tell you a funny story.
He mustered 470 men escorting one person.
Yeah.
Under the night sky?
Yeah.
Is it going to get noticed?
Yeah, that would be noticed. Yeah, it would be noticed. But that's plenty big enough to keep away 40 rebels who want to assassinate Paul.
Yeah. And they mentioned that they were probably zealots in one of the notes.
Oh, the 40 rebels?
Yeah.
The 40 Jews?
Be, yeah.
They might have been zealots. That could be.
The terrorist group?
Yeah.
Okay. Simon Peter was a zealot, correct?
No.
Yes. Simon Peter was not a zealot, but the other Simon was. Yeah. And the key word there was. So, or, no. Yeah. Anyway, I don't know if he gave up his zealot ways or not, so.
According to the chosen, he did.
Yeah, according to the chosen, he did, okay. I kind of think he probably did. You know, he stopped being a zealot and following their ideas, yeah.
They were trained assassins.
They were trained assassins, yeah, right. That's what they did, and they were the ones that expected the Messiah to be the king, and so they were ready to start assassinating Romans as soon as the Messiah appeared. So they kind of considered themselves underground soldiers for the coming Messiah to assassinate Romans. Yeah, they were assassins. Absolutely true. All right. So, yeah, that's a big group there of Roman soldiers to escort Paul, one prisoner. He wrote a letter to this effect. So let's read the letter. It's not particularly long. Claudius Lysias. Oh, now we know the name of the tribune. Okay? And I think somewhere somebody has connected that with Roman history. So, you know, again, it's rooted in history and truth. Claudius Lysias to His Excellency the Governor Felix. Greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them when I came upon them with the soldiers and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman citizen. Ooh, it makes it sound like that was the reason for his rescue. So Claudius here, even though he's a military tribune, he's still got a little political sense about himself, doesn't he? Because he's making it sound to the governor, I heard he was a Roman citizen, so I went and rescued him. That's not actually quite the right order of things. Okay, so having learned he was a Roman citizen, and desiring to know the charge for which they were accusing him, I brought him down to their council. I found that he was being accused about questions of their law, but charged with nothing deserving death or imprisonment. Again, that's true. So he's telling him the full truth here. He's not kind of mushing it around like that first sentence. He did bring them to their council, and in his eyes as a Roman, he's like, this is all a dispute among you about your religions. Why do I care as a Roman? He doesn't. He just wants to keep the peace. So he's writing the truth. I don't see anything deserving of death or imprisonment for Paul. Boy, doesn't this sound familiar from somebody else?
Yes.
Pontius Pilate and Jesus. Pilate knew Jesus was innocent. He knew this was a religious dispute between Jesus and the Jewish leaders. And yet he caved in, didn't he? Pontius Pilate did. Okay, verse 30. And when it was disclosed to me that there would be a plot against this man, I sent him to you at once, ordering his accusers also to state before you what they have against him. So, clearly that letter is indicating to us that Claudius was not going to hide from the Jewish leaders that he shipped Paul off to the governor. But he would tell them, I shipped Paul off to the governor, so go lodge your complaints with him and tell him what your concerns and accusations are. So he's completely passing the buck. Both sides of the argument. Okay? Alright. So the soldiers, according to their instructions, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. And on the next day, they returned to the barracks, letting the horsemen go on with him. Oh, that's kind of interesting detail. Again, why do we need to know this? So the foot soldiers only accompanied him halfway and then came back. And then the horsemen continued to escort him the rest of the way. I guess Claudius, the tribune, must have figured once he's halfway there, he's out of danger from the rebels. I don't know. But it's kind of an interesting detail. Verse 33, when they had come to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they presented Paul also before him. On reading the letter, he asked what province he was from. And when he learned that he was from Cilicia, he said, I will give you a hearing when your accusers arrive. And he commanded him to be guarded in Herod's praetorium. So why did the governor ask what province he's from? To establish that it really is his problem.
No.
Is this from one of my provinces? Okay, I guess I gotta deal with it. That's kind of his attitude. If they had been from somewhere else, he would have shipped them off to some other governor. Okay? And then he says, okay, we'll wait. And in the meantime, Paul, you're under house arrest in Herod's Praetorium. Now, Jill, do you remember anything about Herod's Praetorium? We visited there in Caesarea Maritima on our Israel trip.
Yes.
Do you remember? A grand palace right on the Mediterranean, including a pool that would be filled with water from the Mediterranean Ocean, and it had a grand view, and just over to the side was the horse racing track for Caesarea Maritima, where they would have horse races, chariot races, and behind them is the city at large. What's that?
Amphitheater
was back here.
Luxury.
And it was luxurious. Herod's Praetorium in Caesarea Maritima. Well, that's a good place to be under house arrest.
Yeah.
So Paul is being treated well. That's my point. He's being treated well, and they are honoring his Roman citizenship by giving him lots of deference and lots of understanding, and he's still going to be on trial when his accusers get there in a matter of whatever, a week or something. But in the meantime, yeah, relax, Paul. Enjoy Herod's old palace. I just think that's wonderful. I'm like, that's how to be under house arrest. Yeah, Rich?
The Tribune, he actually saved Paul's life here, because if he would have said, you know, he's not guilty, there's nothing wrong with him, he would have turned him loose on the streets. They would have,
they would have assassinated
him down and killed him.
Yeah. He did save Paul's life. You're absolutely right. Alright, see, that brings us to the end of chapter 23, and look at that, we still have like 7 minutes to spare. Questions, other comments, you guys have had some good questions. Anything else? Other thoughts or comments? Yeah, Greg.
Another history question. Is this area still considered the armpit of the Roman Empire? Because they usually sent people there from Rome that fell in disfavor.
Yeah.
Is it still like
at the time of Pontius Pilate, Pilate despised his appointment there because it was considered the backwater area of the empire at the time of Pontius Pilate. Whether it's still thought of that way at this point, I don't know. That's a good question. I would suspect yes, because the Roman soldiers despised the Jews just like the Jews despised the Roman soldiers. So a Roman soldier would be like, oh, where did you get your orders to pull duty? Oh, I'm on the south of France. Oh, good for you. Where are you going? Oh, I'm going to Palestine. Oh, yeah. I suspect they did still look down upon this area and these people, but I don't know. That's a good question, though, because they did for a long time look down on it. Jeannie, you had your hand up?
Yeah, back to this high priest. Was he the same high priest that when Jesus was
trial? No.
No.
I think I saw somewhere in my reading, he's like three high priests later. So whether he's related, and that's why he has the same name, you know, a great-grandson or a great-nephew, I don't know. I didn't notice that. But it is a different one than Ananias at the time of Jesus.
Okay. Because at Jesus' so-called trial, Caiaphas was a high priest, but wasn't there also a son-in-law or somebody
yes.
that shared it? And was that the Ananias?
Yes. Okay. Correct. Different Ananias, though. Yeah,
under God's law.
That's right. He was not acting as an appropriate high priest. And so when Paul predicted, God will strike you down, and then Celeste, I think you pointed out in the footnotes, it says that he was assassinated by his own people. Well, there you go. He was struck down. Paul's prediction came true, right? He was a wicked high priest. Absolutely.
But this whole scenario, one thing after another, you just see God's hand in all. God's
you can.
You will go to Rome.
Right. And let me use that as a way to just tie in, maybe wrap this up for tonight and all, but remember the overall theme of the book of Acts. What happens with the gospel message? Luke and Acts, the gospel of Luke and the book of Acts, both written by Luke. The gospel of Luke explains the question, what is the gospel? The gospel is about Jesus Christ. The book of Acts says, what does the gospel do? Well, what does the gospel do? It gets preached. And when it's preached, there is some success and some conversions, and it's also there is some persecutions and some resistance. That's what happens when the gospel is preached. Here again, and I think you're right, Jeannie, there's God's hand in this, preserving Paul's life for what purpose? Jesus himself, in a dream or a vision, said to Paul, I want you to go to Rome and preach there. So again, it's about the preaching of the gospel. And Paul's life is being preserved for that purpose. And as Paul is preaching, what's happened? Some people are converted, become strong, faithful, courageous Christians, and some people are resistant and persecuting. So you see that, right, with the gospel message. And you still see it here, too, in this chapter as well. All right, any one last question or comments, anybody? All right, why don't we rise and close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Thanks for coming. Have a good evening.